So today we're bringing back a Tectonic veteran, Jessica Kriegel, the chief scientist at a company named Culture Partners. We're going to tackle a topic so many of our member companies are now struggling with, change management. I am Thomas Law, the executive director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. We're going to get this insight engine humming. Jessica, welcome back. And if you can reintroduce yourself to the audience here at Tectonic, and specifically, what is the role of a chief scientist at Culture Partners? What's that all about?
Well, I lead research and strategy at Culture Partners around best practices for driving results in business. Our purpose is to drive results by activating your culture. And we believe that culture is the way that people think and act to get results. So it's not about ping pong tables, and it's not about Thirsty Thursdays or free kombucha in the break room. It's really about how people operate in order to drive results. And so I'm constantly working with organizations and then doing research around what works and what doesn't work. And then I share that in the form of keynotes and on my podcast, Culture Leaders, and, you know, in the media and in writing and in the reports that we publish.
Yeah, you delivered a fantastic keynote for us at TSW in Vegas last October on the culture equation. And I know it was super well received. And so really appreciated that. And you're going to do another keynote for us coming up here in October in Vegas. And I love the title of this thing. It's basically how to get people to give a shit. Do I have that correct? Is that basically?
That is correct. How to get people to give a shit is the name of the keynote.
All right, that's
I'm
perfect.
Proud of you for saying it.
Well, this is our podcast. We can, you know, we can drop a couple swear. Yeah, exactly. So I really look forward to your insights on that topic. But today I want to focus on change management because I know that's another area that you research. And I want to start with just a simple question of how do you define or scope change management? Because that could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So just kind of paint that box for me.
Well, I think the way that it has been defined and the way that it typically is defined is exactly the problem with change management. And we need to think about it differently. So maybe we can start there, which is change management. The way that it exists in the hearts and minds of most business leaders and even change management consultants today is treated as episodic in nature. Mm-hmm. So we are currently yellow and we need to turn blue. And so we're going from yellow to blue. And what we need to do is first understand the difference between yellow and blue. And then we need to understand what kind of structure for our business will better support blue. And then we're going to figure out what new job roles exist in the world of blue. Let's reskill our talent so that they're comfortable with blue. And we're going to get rid of the people who aren't on board with blue, because blue is where we're headed. And that is the way of the future. And once we've moved to blue, we're done. And that is such a silly way of thinking about change management, because it is a slow pace, which we've not been moving at that slow pace for a long time in business. And so instead of thinking of it as from yellow to blue, and then you have to start all over again, by the way, because before you even really get to blue, you've decided now it's time to turn pink, right? Mm-hmm. And so instead of thinking about it that way, the way that I talk to people about change management is architecting your business to embrace continuous change and build that muscle, as opposed to just figuring out what one particular change needs to happen today and how to get from yellow to blue. That's just, it's too short-sighted and it doesn't build the muscle to create a winning team.
Yeah, it's interesting as you describe that. I mean, so I'll put that in our vernacular. We have, over the last decade, 15 years, been watching a lot of technology companies go from yellow to blue in the sense that they had very traditional tech models where they sold, you know, product that was on-prem, disconnected. And then they said, hey, we really want to become more of a SaaS-based or as a service company, which is a fundamentally different business model, right? And it impacts everybody, right? Finance, service, sales, et cetera. But I think their approach is very traditional, which is what you described, right? We were this kind of, had this kind of business model. We are marching over to this other business model, and then we will be done. And, you know, so many of the companies aren't even done with that experience. And then you now have a whole new wave of technology capabilities and AI, and what's that going to mean to business models? So I completely on board what you're saying is, especially for tech companies, it just is this sort of wave after wave of continuous change. and it is not this discrete event where you just get to declare victory. So I totally get that. But one of the things that I think is very interesting when I talk to executive teams just about that transformation on their business model is I think that a lot of executive teams think that they have these cultures that are, hey, we're agile, we embrace innovation and change. But I find that a lot of employees loathe change. they don't. And so what is your experience there at the employee level? When you talk about change management, now we're talking about continuous change. What's the appetite, and maybe how do you get people to embrace that more than resist it?
Well, let's talk about moving from on-prem to cloud, because that was where I started in my change management journey. I was at Oracle for 10 mm-hmm. years, and I was there when they hired a guy named Sean Price to be the head of cloud, and his mission was to turn Oracle into a cloud company, coming from what he described Oracle as not having any cloud DNA at the time. Right. 5% mm-hmm. of Oracle revenue came from cloud, and he was trying to get it to be what it is today, which is 70% of their revenue comes from cloud. So at the time, right, this was like 2013, at the time, they did treat it like we're going to go from on-prem to cloud. And it required changes to the business model. It required changes to the language we used, required changes to the buyer that we were speaking to, the language that we were using, the way that we contracted, the way, you know, everything changed, everything, right? One of the simple examples of a huge change that happened is the entire implementation consulting department disappeared, right? And they turned into customer success. Yeah. So that was like, hey, we're going to the cloud model. We don't need this anymore. Now we need this. And we're not focused on implementation as much as we're focused on consumption and adoption. Mm-hmm. And those are the things that we need you to help our clients with now. But then you look at UKG, for example, just had those massive layoffs. You know what entire department just got laid off? Customer success. So what are they doing now? What are you talking about? You can't get rid of customer success. You're a cloud company. Well, they're now just pushing all that to their partners. They're outsourcing because mm-hmm. they're a tech company and they get valued higher on tech stuff than they do on people stuff. So they're like, well, let's just give the people stuff to someone else. Yep. And that's going to have implications for their organization. And I think the rest of tech is probably going to follow at some point. But here's the point. That's an example of why employees hate change. To go back to your question, they hate mm-hmm. change because it's treated like episodic from on-prem to cloud. And they're like, I thought we are done, but now we're having a whole new change. And we hate it because mm-hmm. we're not teaching employees how to get comfortable with continuous change. We're just teaching employees about the next thing, getting them attached to that static way of being, because the next thing is the change we're managing today. And then it's changing again. And they're getting frustrated because we create entire awareness campaigns around this new way. And then by the time I'm finally comfortable with the new way, it gets abandoned. So that's why employees hate change. It's not because of employees. It's because of the way that change is being managed. They hate change management the way that it exists today because it's so short-sighted. Now, the way that you create employees who are embracing change is, we can talk about that next, is about changing their mentality and changing the way that we react to shifts in our strategy and our workplace. And then when that change happens, the next thing happens, they're like, right, we were waiting for you. This is the next thing that we were prepared would happen.
So as I listen to you on that, and you know, I'm not an expert on, you know, the psychology of employees, but you know, I think one of the reasons management teams, they like to sort of put the goal there and make it a discrete event, is that they don't want to, you know, just basically burn people out in the sense that, hey, we're just going to be constantly changing, so just get used to that, right? So they don't want to overwhelm them. So they say, hey, you know, we're doing this transition right now, and we get there, it's going to be great, and our business model is going to be better, and you're going to be so much happier. And so they sort of, you know, paint the unicorns and the rainbows and all that kind of stuff, and to get people comfortable, hopefully motivated, and not feel like, oh my God, but then 6 months later, 12 months later, here comes another. And so when you say prepare people to embrace continuous change, how do you do that in a way that you are not just basically saying that they're like, oh my God, this is exhausting?
Yeah. Well, first you stop treating people like idiots. You know, like, that's basically what managers are doing. They're saying, "Hi, nice to meet you, employee number 478. We're just going to do this one little medium little size change. And you're going to be so happy with the new reality. And trust me, it's going to be rainbows and unicorns." And then that's not true. Yeah. And then people know it's not true because after 6 months, now they've got to do the next change. And so that is the mentality that leaders need to hide information from employees to prevent them from getting upset is exactly the thing that is making them upset, right? So it's about building a mindset and a skill to scale continuous change, which we can talk about how to do that. And it has to do with, like, for example, there's strategy and there's culture, right? So strategy is the big bets that your leadership team has made on how you're going to win. And your culture is the way that people think and act. So your strategy change is really easy. Companies change their strategy all the time because all that's required is a bunch of executives to get into a boardroom somewhere and say, "You know what? We should try this." And they're all like, "Sounds good. Write that down." And now your strategy is different, right? That's the end. Now, what are you doing, leaders, once you leave that boardroom, to get all 40,000 employees that report into you on board with that new strategy? That's making sure that the way people think and act is about to adapt to the new decision that you've made. Now, that strategy change that I just described happens within one fiscal year all the time. Like, I don't know a single company that doesn't have some tweak to their strategic initiatives within every fiscal year. It's not like, well, in 3 years, we're going to change our strategy. There's always something that happens. I mean, AI is only, what, a year old, and it's completely blown up the entire industry. So that requires not one change. It's not like the change is AI, right? AI requires entirely new ways of thinking and operating and hiring and firing and leading and communicating and process improve. All of that is changing. And so we just need to focus on the way that people think and act, which you can systematize and you can scale. That should be the next question you ask me is like, well, how do you do that? Because once you figure out how you do that, you're treating people like adults and saying like, here's the way that it's going to be. Let's operate this way. And then people get comfortable with that way of operating and all of the changes don't bother them as much because they're no longer being treated like this is a need to know basis and you don't need to know that in 6 months everything's going to change again because they already know. They've been in business. They are people. They understand.
So I am going to ask you about how you scale it. And I think we've done over 100 episodes and you are the first guest who is providing their own questions that I should be asking. And if every guest did that, I mean, my job would be so, I wouldn't have to prepare. This is awesome. I really wish every guest was operated the same way. I just gonna sit back and say, okay, what's the next question? But we're going to go there on scale. But I want to rewind just a little bit with what you opened up with there around, you know, how management teams treat employees, right? And that they're, and the employees get frustrated because they're not being given all the information or, you know, there's not enough transparency there. And I will tell you candidly that I see that happening big time with, you know, what the impact of AI is going to be on tech business models, because it is absolutely going to be a game changer in productivity. It is absolutely going to disrupt, you know, a lot of different roles. And the talk track from all these management teams is, oh, hey, this is nothing, again, but rainbows and unicorns. This is going to be great. It's just going to make you a more high value added employee. But there are going to be consequences here. Jobs are going to go away. That's a fact. 20-30%.
Oh, yeah.
And every time I ask an executive about that, I say, well, how are you communicating that piece? Well, employees are not stupid. So I hear you on that. And I think that we are about to step in it in a big way as an industry, but by not being candid and honest with our employees about what AI is ultimately going to mean to the workforce.
Yeah. I call it the Pollyanna delusion. And I was talking to the CEO of a large organization that everyone here has heard of about this. And they said, you know, well, obviously it's going to be devastating to the employee population, but I can't tell them that. But, you know, when I talk to other CEOs about this, everyone knows. I mean, so there is the talk in the back room by CEOs about this, and it is not being shared with their employees. And the reality is the Pollyanna delusion is the idea that if you don't say something, they won't know.
Right.
I think corporate communications has gotten so out of touch with reality that when you hear a CEO speak on a town hall, on an investor call, in any formal capacity, they have bullet points that have been scrubbed so clean,
yep,
so as to reduce liability and friction, potential conflict or politics emerging from those talking points, that they're basically saying nothing most of the time.
Yeah.
And that is so obviously inauthentic that it is off-putting to employees. And it's also not working, because the reality is today, you know, that worked 40 years ago when information was top down and there was just one way that communication worked, and it was through these official channels. But now information sharing is so multi-directional in nature because of social media and, you know, websites like Glassdoor and Blind and places mm-hmm. like that, where people can go, and your CEO may not be saying it, but everyone knows that bonuses were not given out this year. Everyone knows that the CEO just cashed out their shares. Everyone knows all of the drama, and everyone knows that that leader is super toxic because they're being called out publicly on these anonymous forums online and on social media, sometimes not anonymously. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you can't control the narrative anymore, but they're still acting like they can.
Yeah.
And it's just coming off as totally out of touch.
Yeah.
You have to be more transparent as a leader today.
I completely agree with you on that. So now back to our theme of change management and how we can get people to lean into it in a more continuous thought. How do you scale change management effectively? What are some of the key tactics there?
Great question. So I have a friend and colleague named Greg Sattel who wrote a great book on change called Cascades. You should read it if you haven't. But essentially, the way that change management is currently scaled, and I'm doing air quotes for those of you not seeing me on video, because it is just a bad, ineffective way of, quote, scaling change, is through communication campaigns. So it starts with a big announcement. And then it goes to, you know, repeating the messaging and creating an awareness campaign via email, via town hall, via management cascading communications. And like, the more we talk about this, the more people are going to see it's the wave of the future and they're going to get on board with it. But people don't change because of communication campaigns, and awareness isn't working. So what is the more effective way to do it? People change because they see things working and they want to get on board with what's working. So the most, actually, ironically, the quickest way to enact change is to start really small, where you identify the people who are within the organization that are uber enthusiastic about the change. Mm-hmm. For every change, there's that bell curve of people who are totally on board and then not at all on board and just don't care in the middle, right? So find those people who were like the early adopters, tipping point folks that are like, yeah, I want to do, like, I'm super interested in the cloud, or I'm super interested in AI, or I'm super interested, whatever the new thing is, mm-hmm. right? And you find those people and you're like, okay, you guys just play with it and do this and let's see what happens. And you create a small pilot of that change that they, when they run into roadblocks, when they hit a challenge, when they get into some unanticipated problem that blocks progress, they're the people who are going to be like, I got this. Let's problem solve. Let's get together. Oh my goodness. How can we overcome this? Right? Because they're so excited about doing it. So they're exactly the people that you want to be at the tip of the spear mm-hmm. in that change. Because when they see a problem, it doesn't justify that this was a big mistake all along in their minds. They're like, ooh, challenge. Let's overcome and see how we can really make a difference here. And then they become the champions. They start talking, they start sharing the story of success that they had in their small world. And people see that success, see what results they got. So AI is a perfect example. Get the super AI freaks that are really excited about it and give them a budget to go play with it and create process improvement or productivity enhancements in some way. And then let them tell the story, because they're going to be the greatest advocates for it, about how they're winning because of it. And then people are going to see that, be like, wait, I want some. Mm-hmm. And they're going to jump on board. That's how, as a Culture Partners, when we create culture change at scale, we identify the culture champions, the people who are super into culture, right? And super into leading that kind of stuff. There's always those people on the team that raise their hand saying, like, I want to be on that committee, right? And those people are going to be the advocates that get everyone else on board because they will have created an impact. They will already have the winning story in the rearview mirror for them that then they can tell the story of. And storytelling is a powerful motivator. You hear a story and you're like, how do I get on board with that? As opposed to, we have an idea that in the future will make a difference if only you agree with us. And here it is to everyone. And then you get the noise from all factions of your employee base, people who are on board with it and the people who are the major resistors, and then everyone else like not paying attention. And where is the energy going to go? To the apathy that is the overwhelming reaction that most people have is like, ugh, I don't care about that.
So you put a lot on the table there. And so let me just click into some of these things. And when you're telling that model, the tactic of find people who are enthusiastic, in a sense, early adopters, have them be the tip of the spear. Let me give you an example. You know, from my past, one of the first things I worked on was helping technology companies when they wanted to grow their internal professional service capabilities. And so they'd be a product company and say, hey, we should be doing more PS because it'll make us stickier with the customer. I mean, whatever their business reasons were. So then they would turn to a sales force that basically was very good at selling product, but really shitty at selling services, right? And they go, gosh, like, how do we get them to change? How do we do some change management? And one of the best tactics always was what you just said. You find a salesperson who gets it. And they're like, oh, I totally get it. If I sell more PS, it's, you know, I'm going to be stickier. I'm going to get bigger deals. I'm in, right? And then they would go out and they would sell. And then what you would do, you know, when you're doing your big club celebrations, you get that salesperson up there on a stage and hey, they made their number and they blew their number out and they sold a gazillion dollars of PS. And you use that example, right? And you want other salespeople to go, oh, I want some of that. So I absolutely agree with you. My question, though, is I would see some companies that catalyst would be enough to start tipping the rest of the sales force. Other times, it fizzled out. You know what I'm saying? So those early adopters, because as you know, you can be super enthusiastic on something, but as they say, you know, the pioneers are the ones that get the arrows in the back, right? So you could be out there, have a lot of energy, but if you just don't start to move that middle, that apathy, eventually it can die. So talk a little bit about the tactics to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, great question. So
I can come up with good questions sometimes on my own. It's amazing.
So this is where the results pyramid comes into play. And this is how you manage a change in the way that people think and act to get results, which is culture transformation. And so results come from actions. Everyone knows that, right? We sell more PS, we get more sales that we want to see, and that's the result. So you're trying to get people to sell more professional services. That's the action you want them to take to get the result. Well, leaders kind of stop there. Most leaders, you know, they're like, I need to get them to sell more professional services. So then we tell everyone, we need you to sell more professional services. You tell marketing, give them more decks that will help them do sales enablement activity around getting them to sell professional services. And then you like get them information and then you have a call on your rev call. And it's like, we're going to acknowledge everyone who sold professional services. And then you're going to just follow up on your one-on-one management calls. How many professional services did you pitch today? And did you put that in Salesforce? And, you know, that's the action trap, we call that. That is not going to work. That's what most change management looks like, right? And what you have to do is get at the thing that drives us to take action. And that is our beliefs. What is the belief that the sales team has about whether or not selling professional services is what's in it for them, right? So do they believe that they're going to make more money? Do they believe that it is an easier sell? Do they believe that there's friction in that? Do they believe, like, what are their beliefs about selling professional services? And you have to dig into that. If you don't understand what they believe about that, then you can't shift the beliefs. And ultimately, shifting the beliefs are what get people to take action, not micromanaging their activity. If you micromanage their activity, you're going to irritate them, you're going to nag them, you're going to burn them out, and ultimately you're going to burn yourself out because then you got to do all the follow-up on, did you do the activity? Did you do the activity? If you shape a new belief, then the activity takes off, right? And you don't have to be there looking over their shoulder to make sure that it took off. So understanding beliefs, which requires the listening and the communication and the hard conversations and being open to resistance to change, which is ironic because actually it's the resistance to change that informs you about the problems in your plan. But really understanding how you can shift those beliefs. Well, what drives our beliefs is experiences. So getting that salesperson on stage to say, I made my number and here's how, and tell the story is an experience that you're creating for the team to say, maybe your belief should shift about this, right? And then maybe it did for some and not others. That's one experience though. And the reason that most of those initiatives fizzle out is because they're like, we created an experience. Aren't we done here? Why aren't they on board? Those are change resistors. You know, the reality is we have to create a multitude of experiences. And the simplest experiences that you can lean into are storytelling, which is what getting that guy on stage to tell the story is about. Recognition. So the first time someone sells something that you're trying to get them to sell that they hadn't previously sold, you sing it from the rooftops. You give them bonus, a spot bonus for embracing adoption of this new thing. You create reward mechanism for that embracing of change, even if it's just a pat on the back. Good job, buddy. That was great. Thanks. You know? And then the third is feedback. Like the people who are not doing it, give them feedback. Like, well, we noticed this and here's where I see you embracing change. Here's where you could embrace change a little bit more. When I was working with Sean Price to move Oracle from on-prem to a cloud company, one of the things that he set as his personal goal was to have every rep sell a cloud deal every quarter. And it was like, if we can just get every rep to just sell one per quarter, which was not the ultimate goal, but it was just about, we just want to get them on board with the idea. And so one small win is the starting point. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where we want to begin.
Yeah. In this concept of beliefs, right? And how important that is to get people to change, to just riff on that for a moment, back to as a service transformation. So, you know, we've written a lot about this. We've researched a lot about how companies go through that business model transformation. And one of the most common, you know, conversations I get into with executive teams is about that transformation. So, hey, you know, and let's just pick on some of the hardest profiles, which are on-prem hardware companies. Just think about a company that's not even selling software like Oracle was, but they're selling hardware. They've been doing it for 10 years, 20 years. And now they're like, gosh, we want to have more as a service revenue. We want to maybe start to move where we're in managed service, you know, relationships with customers, et cetera, et cetera. So they'll bring me in to talk about that. And they want to go right to the how. Right. So tell us, how does a hardware company do this? And how do they deal with the financials? And how? And I always back them up and I say, well, but I think we want to spend more quality time first on the why. Because what I find is if an executive team, if there's people in that room, could be the head of sales, could be the head of product, could be whoever, right? Head of service, could be the CEO themselves. If they don't really think there's there on the why, they don't really believe it. They're just sort of like, yeah, you know, we should do this as a service thing because it's a cool thing to do. But underneath, they're like, I'm not there on the why. So I think it comes to the heart of what you're saying on belief. And I'm just going to put this on the table in terms of your thoughts in successful change management. It does start at the top in terms of if you're going to go through some painful change, you have to have an executive team that believes in this change. And if they're half-assed in it or they're fractured on it, then to me, you just shot yourself in the foot and you can't even get out of the gates because you're not going to carry the employees through this if the leadership doesn't have conviction and belief on this. So I'm curious what your experience is on that.
Yeah, I like that as an idea. And what I see more often with leadership teams is I would say that conviction and belief is the ideal, but really what we need is alignment. One of the things we do as executive alignment sessions is getting everyone aligned on what the purpose of our organization is, the strategy for how we're going to get there, and the culture that we need to achieve those results, and then agreement on how we're going to measure all of that to know that we've won. And I love the conversations with leadership teams where there's fierce disagreement about the path forward. And like I was just in one a couple months ago, and I saw this leader just rabidly defending this other approach that the CEO did not think was the right approach. And there was heavy debate throughout the day. And ultimately, they ended up voting, was how they decided to make a choice after this massive debate. And he said, I want it to be known that I am adamantly against this as our path forward. But now that we've voted, I am totally aligned. So sometimes as executives, you don't get to all be convicted, you know, you don't get to have the same beliefs, but you get to choose as a leader to get aligned regardless of those beliefs, right? It's different when you're trying to get a whole bunch of people on board. There you need them to believe, because it's a lot harder when the person is not empowered, when they're not in the decision-making seat, when they don't have the financial incentive to get on board regardless of their beliefs, right? That's where you really want to drive belief. But sometimes alignment is good enough. Alignment is actually even more powerful because it shows a commitment to that team.
I'm on board with what you're saying there. And I think, you know, in the real world, there's no doubt that management teams can say, hey, look, we don't all have the same belief system here, but there is a strategy we're going to go chase and we have to be aligned on it. And, you know, we're going to be professionals about this and now we're going to go do it. And then what you're saying is the goal is for that next level down in the organization, the belief is super important there because you really want them to believe in that strategy if you want them to lean into whatever changes is required. The only other, you know, sort of comment I'll make on that is when there are senior leaders who don't believe, right? But they go, oh, that's okay, I'm aligned. They shake their head up and down. I am going to put on the table, that's a coin toss. So half the time, they're probably good to the word and say, hey, I'm all in, I'm aligned. You know, I don't believe, but I'm aligned. I will go be a good soldier, if you will. Half the time, they're saying, yeah, I'm aligned. And then they are right from that moment, you know, working to basically not make the change successful. I've seen that. So I think that's unfortunate. I don't know what, you know, the percentages are you see, you know, in terms of that, but that's definitely, I think it is a coin toss if they're really going to lean in or not.
Yeah. I mean, that's when the CEO needs to get rid of that.
Absolutely.
Because if that's not executive level work or thinking, right? Yep. That's just amateur level. So, yeah, I mean,
totally agree.
The CEO needs to have the courage to say, you're out. Like, we need people who can lead. And that's not leadership, right? That's like totally drama and politics and selfish and ego based.
Yeah. But there's a lot of amateur leadership, you know, out there for sure. Yeah. So it exists. Right. That's why I say it's 50-50. It's a coin toss. So another question I had. So what is the role, again, getting people to believe, what is the role of things like data and analytics and helping to enable change management, helping getting people to believe? Is there a tactic there that you've seen?
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny. I could use my career as an example to answer that question. So it depends on the level that you are operating at. If data and analytics convinced anyone to believe anything, then we would all be super fit because we've seen the data and analytics about how eating healthy and working out is good for you. And yet we still have a whole bunch of people not eating healthy and working out, right? So in and of itself, as a concept, data drives beliefs? Not really. Right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't drive beliefs that actually turn into action because I could give you 10 more examples of how that is true for you and me, right? Having said that, executives lean into data and analytics to make decisions because let's get into the psychology of this. They want something to blame if they were wrong. Mm-hmm. They want backup for the fear that they experience on making a choice. The hard thing about being a leader is making decisions and potentially being wrong. And so having data and analytics to support the decision allows you a buffer of if something goes wrong. That's why leaders love data, not because it's like convincing, because they need backup, right? So when I was early in my career at Oracle, I was the kind of culture transforming leader person that was like really all about people and like the human side of business and, you know, do the right thing. And I was the touchy feely woo woo person because like I care about people. And I found that that went nowhere because like doing the right thing does not drive a leader to make choices because the leader is being measured on their ability to create shareholder value or whatever their particular metric is. That's really always about revenue in some way, right? So to say, do the right thing, I can sit with someone in a room and they can be like, my heart gets that. I care about that too. Also, no, thank you, because I don't have budget for that because I have to drive results. And so I'm going to lean on my people and do the things that are, you know, going to make them miserable because it will help us win. So I realized ultimately that like that was never going to work. And if you look at the people who talk about that, like they're businesses either aren't that large or their business is driven mostly by employees who wish that leaders thought more like that, right? They're like consumer facing thought leaders. The B2B winners are the ones who tell the story about what drives results. And so the data does actually support making the right choice in order to drive results. And I realized that I had to be able to tell that story in order to get leaders to have permission to invest in the right thing, because it actually does drive results. As simple as diversity on your team, making people feel like they belong, driving culture, right? Culture is how people think and act. One of the games I play with CEOs when I sit down with them for the first time is I give them a choice. I'm like, let me ask you this question. However big your team is, let's say you have 100 people, let's say you have 100,000 people. If I told you right now that you had to cut 20% of those people, but the 80% that are left are going to give a shit, they're going to care so much about the results that you're trying to achieve, do you take the deal, or do you keep the 100% of your staff the way that they care right now? All of them take the deal. Mm-hmm. I have yet to meet a CEO who's like, oh no, I have to keep that 20%, right? So one of the challenges that leaders often have is like, my people just don't care. What they want is people to care, because they know if they care, they believe they're going to take the action to change whatever it is that we're transforming into, and they're going to drive results. So this change management thing and the how to get people to give a shit is actually very tied together.
Yep, yep.
Because right now you're dealing with a bunch of apathy with regards to change or whatever, and it's not driving the results necessary. So I see myself as the evangelist that leverages data as necessary to get people to do the right thing, because ironically, mm-hmm. it actually does get results. And there is a false narrative that it's people or profit. Mm-hmm. And if you lean too heavy into people, you're going to lose out on profit. And if you lean too heavy into profit, your people are going to suffer. And that is a false narrative. The reality is what people want is a job where they really care and they're excited about their job. That's like fulfilling and engaging. And what CEOs want is a bunch of people who care. So we all want the same thing. And the thing that we all want is what makes us feel good about our lives, and also what makes the business make money. And that is the thing I'm trying to get in people's heads. It's like, it's not a zero-sum game. You know, we can all win together. Yeah. We just have to stop talking about it like it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah. So again, you put a lot on the table there, but just to play back, you know, specifically on the data side of it, I completely agree with you, because I mean, we create data for a living. You know, we do tons of operational benchmarking, et cetera. And, you know, in the perfect world, people would use data and it would inform beliefs, right? They'd be like, oh, wow, look at that data. But I agree with you. A lot of times what they're using data to do is, number one, just reinforce a belief they already have. So they'll point to it and say, look, see, I told you. Or number two, like you just said, it is the backstop. It is the way to basically say, I follow the data there, you know? And so it's a little bit of a CYA type strategy, but it's still important and effective there, to your point. I mean, if using the data in those ways to reinforce, we've made this decision, this is why we're making some of these decisions, I think there's nothing wrong with that. But what I really on board what you said is that, do people simply make decisions based on the data? Absolutely not. I think that's a false narrative in the world of business. Some people go like, oh, we're totally data driven, we just follow the data. I've never seen that really happen. You know, it's just, it's super interesting. So I'm going to ask you one more question here. I'm keeping an eye on the clock. When it comes to change management, I mean, you've talked a lot about different tactics, but what would you categorize as the biggest misses when a management team goes after this? And you've hit on some of the things that we do not correctly, but just any other big misses you would coach people on to say, hey, this is what you do not want to do?
I think one of the misses is not focusing on driving accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So accountability is ultimately the activator for anything. If people take accountability, then you're going to see something happen. If they don't, you're not. And the founders of our company 35 years ago wrote a book about driving accountability called The Oz Principle. It's a pretty well-known book.
Mm-hmm.
And it created this simple framework, which is above the line thinking and below the line thinking. And when you're below the line, you're in the victim mentality of blame gaming other people. I didn't know about that. That's mm-hmm. not my job. Bob is the one who's supposed to do that. You know, excuses,
mm-hmm.
or like, oh, woe is me. This is too hard. I can't believe it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then above the line thinking is making a personal choice to focus on what you can control to drive results and not spending a bunch of time on all the things that you cannot control. And so it is totally natural for teams, employees, and leaders to go below the line. And it's just a human tendency, and it's not wrong,
mm-hmm.
and it's not bad. It just is what it is. But what's not helpful is when you stay below the line. And I think a lot of organizations can spend time below the line and then move out of it. And other organizations just live below the line, you know, and it's a CY, it's a fear-based culture that is all about CYA and how do I, you know, make sure to protect myself by blaming. The reality is, just at a personal level, it feels better to make that personal choice to focus on what you can control than it does to stay below the line.
Yeah.
Because staying below the line is very like, I'm under attack. It's very fight or flighty, right? And being above is self-empowerment. It's not waiting for someone to create circumstances in which I feel like I now am empowered. It's like taking, literally, I am taking my own accountability and it feels good. That's like growth, right? So driving a culture of above the line is really helpful. One of the things that we do on our leadership team is we will literally make room for below the line thinking. So we'll say, okay, can we just go below the line for a second? And then it's kind of fun, right? And we're engaging in this little bitch fest that is, you know, a cathartic experience. And and also we're acknowledging that it's useless. We're acknowledging that it is something that sometimes you just need to get out. And then after a couple minutes, we go, okay, let's get above the line. And then we shift the mindset entirely and say, okay, what can we control? You know, and there are steps to do that, which I will be sharing at the conference in October, that will help people really care. And there's also steps, you know, questions as a leader that you can ask your team to help them go from below the line to above the line. Accountability is key to driving any kind of result, whether it's managing change or just day-to-day activities.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, accountability, I agree with you, in my world is creating that closed loop, right? So if you tell employees, hey, we're going to do this, it's really important, we've got to make this change, you're trying to get them to believe. But if you don't have a closed loop to basically hold them accountable that they're not doing what needs to be done to be part of that successful change, that you've got to, you know, my terminology, everyone knows within TSIA is you got to flag the play right when it happens. Don't come and tell me about it 2 months from now. Don't come complaining to me 6 months from now how so-and-so didn't get on board. You got to flag the play right when it's happening and say, hey, that's not the way we're rolling right now, or that's not the way we're doing things anymore. And then we can address it. Right. And get people, you know, to course correct. But yeah, I think it's a great, great comment. So I really look forward to seeing you in Vegas. I think, you know, we're in some ways going to be continuing this conversation here about how we get employees to care. Again, I think, you know, all the topics you are on are always relevant, regardless of the times. But I think right now, there's just so much rapid change occurring within these tech companies. They're just 1,000% more relevant. Just 1,000% more relevant. So kudos to you for chipping on the stuff that is, you know, hopefully going to help management teams get through these interesting times. And look forward to seeing you again in Vegas. And I always close here with the question of the day. And my question to the audience here is, change is now a constant state in technology companies. Do you have a strategy to successfully manage it? Cheers, everybody.